Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to Your Cases on Hold. Thanks for joining us. Hopefully you're in the gym, on the go, or hopefully your case is not on hold. I'm Antonia Chen.
And I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for methodology. And that's methodology with two D's for a double dose of this statistical surveillance.
And I'm just adult reconstruction, and we're much more boring than double D's. So I think of Dunkin' Donuts. We're in Boston, so that's where my mind goes. We'll leave it at that. Disclaimers are the opinions are our own. They do not belong to JBJS. They do not belong to the other deputy editors, the staff, or anyone else. So you can blame us if you don't agree. This is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. As always, good learning is an important thing. So the more you want to learn, please go to the Miller Review Course.
Accept no imitations. You go to a different course, you'll be on the right track, but on the wrong train.
So let's get on the right train here. Let's start with our headlines. Angie, we're going to kick us off on a clinical risk model for surgical site infection following pediatric spine deformity surgery, Matsumoto.
Yes, we knew we would see it again. If you're an avid listener to our previous podcasts, you've heard the last two episodes where we've been discussing machine learning. And this isn't quite machine learning, but these authors do kind of take a machine learning approach, looking at developing a clinical risk model for surgical site infection following pediatric deformity surgery. This is a multi-center study that collected patients undergoing spinal fusion, primary revision, definitive, stapling, all sorts of procedures that they included from a number of different centers. It is a retrospective study. They were able to include almost 3,100 patients in total. I think it's a very interesting work from an epidemiologic standpoint because you have a very large number of cases, which gives you a good clinical mix to some degree. And this can help identify, you know, factors that are informative in the current state of affairs for surgical site infections after surgery for pediatric deformities. And of course, this is probably the most devastating of the most common occurring complications, and is bad for kids. It's bad for the surgical practice. It's bad for the parents. It makes things more difficult and more expensive. So of course we want to minimize, can't ever truly eliminate, of course, but we would want to minimize the occurrence of these interventions these complications following the intervention. They then go on to develop a convenient scoring system. And this is where sort of anesthesia is now calling, saying, the equipment's not in the room and the rep isn't here. So you're getting where I'm going, because I'm just going to, put that part is the part of this that probably needs a pause in any case. They have this pediatric spine risk calculator, and I'm going to paraphrase Stefan from Saturday Night Live here and tell you it has everything. It has neuromuscular, it has ASA, it has if the patient's ambulatory or not, it has MTV's Dan Cortez. No, that's the one thing that it doesn't have, but it will take into account the number of hours of the procedure, the number of surgical volume performed at your facility, and then give you an estimate of the risk of surgical site infection. The problem with the calculator in some respects is that some of these things are not really knowable. Like, you don't know if the procedure is going to be 7 hours or longer until after the procedure is done. And then if it was more than 7 hours, you know, this is not going to be the same estimate that you give the patient and their family when you're in the office with the calculator. Also, the issues with surgical volume, I think, are somewhat cause for caution because it's institutional volume and certain providers, like if you're a private practice provider, you don't necessarily know, you know how much you might do, but you don't know how much the hospital, they, like, I don't know, maybe, yeah, it seems like it should be 100, but maybe it isn't 100. But what if it's 99? Or what if it's 101? Like these are big, blunt instruments, broad strokes that if it's 1,000 versus 101, the one that's doing 1,000 is probably going to be like infinitely better. And this creates a potential for what we call ecological fallacy, which is basically you're characterizing something in a broad stroke, and it's probably right for a certain size of the group or a portion of the group, but it's not necessarily right for all of the group. So my summation of this, very interesting study, very powerful because it's a lot of patients from a lot of different places and some really interesting insights into surgical site infection. Definitely check it out. There is a commentary, so you can see what others thought as well. But in terms of application of the risk calculator, that part, I think more work remains to be done.
That's awesome and super insightful because it always concerns me with these calculators. You know, if your risk is 1.5% versus 2%, does that mean you don't proceed? You do proceed? You know, it's really just a counseling tool, as you say, right? And historically, you can use the number of hours that someone's doing a surgery to apply to what you think is, you know, greater than 7 hours. But I agree with you. This is pretty incredible and that is super comprehensive, the number of variables that it did. And neuromuscular patients, you mostly tell them, you know, hey, your risk of infection is higher. And I feel like that's something we knew when we were residents. And well, I stopped after residency when it came to spine. You kept on the train. But
yeah, but this is peed, so that's a totally different ballpark.
Sure. It's true. But they did happen to have a higher risk of infection just in general because of comorbidities. So not a surprising one, but helpful. It was one of those things to look at those tables, and I was like, that's a lot of information. They just distilled it into that one picture of the phone. I'm like, that's all the back information that goes into this one little area, which is pretty nice. So we like distilled bite-sized little pieces of information.
Yes, we do. That's what we're all about.
That's why we're here, right?
Exactly.
So my next one is looking at defining the patient acceptable symptom state for the Hoos and Koos Jr. after primary joint replacement. And this is from our colleagues at HSS. And what I like about this is using PASS is probably more, I'd say in my mind, and you can tell me from the methodology standpoint, clinically significant compared to the MCID. Both are quote unquote differences in minimal clinical differences, but this really assesses for, you know, what of a target we should hit. It does is useful for future studies and it helps look at patient satisfaction more instead of just saying a Likert scale where you're like, you know, not satisfied to mostly satisfied. So they kind of use moderate improvement or better and better than little improvement as their metric for what they're doing as patient satisfaction. And again, this is a useful tool for future targets that we should hit. And we already have that MCID for Hoos Jr. and Koos Jr., but this is nice for the PASS. It is interesting that the study has 2-year follow-up. I don't think we necessarily need 2-year follow-up for joint replacement patients. For implants, we do. But for the PASS and for MCID, most of the time we tell our patients after 1 year, you'll feel pretty good. So I don't know if you necessarily need the 2 years per se, but it is good to have the 2-year follow-up. And patients are like, oh, it's nice to know at 2 years how I'm doing. The methods, the long section, this is your expertise. You can let me know what your thoughts are on that. From my perspective, it looked pretty convincing and they've done a lot of work in this area. So I commend them obviously on taking this on and they're a good group to take it on, obviously. The thing is, whether or not we're going to actually test on these, you know, we talk about the Kaiser Soze of these. I don't think they're going to ask for the exact number that the PASS is increased by. But understanding the concept of PASS versus MCID might be something actually that might sneak onto these exams as we go forward. What's interesting to me, at least, is it's unusual that the more knees would achieve a PASS state versus a hip patients. Hip patients are technically, quote unquote, more satisfied after joint replacement. Now, the threshold is different for the hip versus the knee. There's no doubt about it. But the percentage that actually achieved that, not clinically significantly different, but a little bit more in our knee patients, in this patient population. Obviously, this is a certain population of patients, right? I would love to see this in a different population of patients to see what their PASS rates are and things like that. And the thresholds are different. It is a well-done study, though, because they do also look at patient demographics, such as age, sex, body mass index, and baseline SF-36, both physical and mental, can affect the PASS rate. You know, so it's not just that, oh, okay, this is their PASS, you know, like a hall PASS. You know, here's your free pass, get out of jail, you know, collect $200 and keep on moving sort of thing. It does affect the pass rate. But I wish there were more factors examined, such as, you know, comorbidities or other areas that could affect the pass rate. But overall, this is a useful study that people will use for research studies going forward. Your thoughts?
A well-done study. I do think the pass and the MCID are eminently testable. So be on the lookout for that advance notice. I think it, you know, no real concerns on this one. Like, it says what it says it wants to do. It achieves what it wants to do. And I think you hit all the talking points.
High praise. All right. Moving on to the
case. High praise. Yep. Now it's, uh-oh, you're in the combat seat, Jonathan Livingston Siegel. That means you're going to have to enter the octagon of lexicon. You better be ready to blast up on this research right here. Your case is on hold, featurette. What are we discussing?
The article is clinical outcome differences in the treatment of impending versus completed pathological long bone fractures. Dr. Schoenfeld, please give me your take.
So this is the article by Gruten colleagues from a combination Dutch research group and our colleagues at Mass General across the way. We in the MGB system, of course, do a lot of musculoskeletal oncology and treatment of metastatic disease, spine and otherwise. So it's a robust cohort for which they can assess these parameters. This has an infographic. It's also free for 30 days, so no excuses. Everyone should be able to be looking at this work and developing their own impressions. It's a really well-done study. Pro tip for those who are interested in doing propensity score matching, they really elucidate their methodology, and you can look at the work that in their method section. And if you're interested in doing propensity score matching for this type of causal inference testing, you can pretty much replicate what they did in your own setting, in your own clinical setting. And I think that following those best practices, you'd end up with a nice result. They were able to include a large number of patients. They were able to identify that those who essentially were treated before they had a full-on pathologic long bone fracture obviously did much better. The idea behind propensity score matching is that you're controlling for the confounding by indication or the selection bias, and that you're able to adjust for all of those parameters that could otherwise influence clinical decision making, such that, you know, you can consider this two balanced groups, one that did not receive the prophylactic fixation for a long bone fracture and the other that did before they went on to a full-on fracture. Of course, for ethical concerns, you could never have a randomized trial of that nature, and that's sort of what they're trying to work around here. So a large number of patients. My only fundamental concern here, you can't get away without me saying something, right, is that, you know, it is a series of patients collected over a relatively long period of time, and that introduces the potential for secular trends. Obviously, the field of orthopedics and oncology care and anesthesia and techniques and perioperative management and decision-making is evolving with time. The proclivity for someone to have a prophylactic fixation in 2000 may be different than it is in 2016 or 2017. And even the imaging to identify that the patient is at risk or the proclivity to order that imaging is different in those timeframes. So there's a number of factors that introduce some potential for residual confounding that it's obviously not as pure as an RCT, but you won't ever be able to get there. And this may very well be the best available that we have short of that. Agree, disagree?
100% agree. Now, I'm a little biased. I do like our colleagues across the pond. but this is an incredibly well-done study. And again, it's a large cohort of patients, especially in tumor. And honestly, the loss to follow-up is low, and that's a really hard one, again, in this patient population, I feel like. And again, the 22 variables of matching, that's impressive. So, you know, the one thing I would say is they excluded patients who had sarcoma. And so it might be interesting, talking about future research studies, to look at sarcoma MET patients specifically for impending versus completed fractures, because this is clinically a really important study, right? You know, you see someone coming in and patient's like, well, I haven't broken yet. You know, I don't feel bad. So like, why don't I just leave it? And now you can easily show the study and being like, you know what? It's a really good idea to fix these. So I really like that. The one thing that's different when it looks at survival, they're looking at 1 year clinical survival. The hazard ratio is 1.3, not a huge amount, 46% versus 38%. So from a percentage wise, but it's statistically significant. And we can go down an entire rabbit hole of p-values, which we won't do right now. But the idea is that the focus on reoperation, that's what I would personally, if I were a tumor surgeon taking up to my patients, say, you know, the odds ratio of getting reoperation is 2.5. That's significantly high. So if you can get it, catch it early, obviously, and be able to treat it appropriately, and they use all different methods of fixation, that's useful. So it was really good. I think it was a really well done one. I would not put this case on hold. Good take home message, and good for patients to know, and good for our surgeons to know as well.
And again, free for 30 days. So everyone within earshot, go to jbjs.org, pull it off, and have a look, because I think this is a very informative and helpful work. Even if you're not working in this area, but you're interested in doing propensity score matching, it's like a primer.
All right. We like those. We like to have a nice little basic beginning book. We all need those. So tell me about something that's a little less basic when it comes to discharge.
Well, now we're going to the toss-up.
Toss-up time. Click six scores. Who needs them?
Well, people who have total hip and knee arthroplasty need them. And apparently everyone needs them. This is about discharge planning, which of course is incredibly important in these times. This is the work by Haddad and colleagues. This is also free for 30 days. So just don't take it from me. Check it out for yourself. And no excuses, easily accessible. This is work done out of the Cleveland Clinic. They compared the plan algorithm, a plan score, which is something that you assess preoperatively, to the AMPAC six-click score, which is like done when they're ready for discharge or after the surgery, at least, you know, somewhere in the post-operative course before they've left the hospital to determine the discharge disposition. Now, a little bit behind the scenes here, the plan score was developed by Barsoom et al. So that's intrinsic Cleveland Clinic proprietary algorithm, if you will. And the AMPAC six clicks has a much broader track record and actually has been validated in the Journal of Arthroplasty by respected colleagues from the Harvard system, Min Kwan and his team. And I think there's at least a better track record in the literature of the AMPAC six clicks than there is for the plan. So they compared plan to the AMPAC six clicks, and basically in all the assessments, the AMPAC six clicks does better. And then they concluded, oh, so you should use both, which reminds me of Monty Python and the Holy Grail after King Arthur chops off the arms and legs of the knight. And then he's like, let's just call it a draw. So they do this comparison. The AMPAC six clicks outperforms. I mean, it's marginal, but let's be honest, it outperforms. And then they're like, so you should just use both. Do the plan beforehand and then the six clicks after the fact. And that part is what's going on hold here, because if there's anything that we need, it's not a million more scoring algorithms to apply in every clinical situation. So I think that what this is showing is the AMPAC six clicks is probably getting where you need to be. And if you're going to do scores for discharge disposition, you could trial that beforehand and trial that after the fact. We do that with the stopping opioids after surgery score. It is ideal to, you get all the information after the fact, but you can get a general good sense of what's going on if you're making the assessment before the fact. You don't have all the parameters. But you can do it beforehand. You can say, okay, this is where I think we're going. And it's only going to be a small number of patients that are kind of on the margins and can be pushed either way. And then you can apply it definitively at the end if that is your wish. But the, so they're both good.
More is better, isn't it? The more you do, the better it is. Just keep piling it on.
And that's why, and then, you know, spend 3 hours in every single clinical encounter.
And you're not getting reimbursed. It's a really good time. So my only question is, can this be used against us? So what if it says, hey, this patient should go home, and this patient ends up not going home, for example, and needs to go to a skilled nursing facility or rehab? They're like, could you see people like insurance companies saying, hey, by the way, you should have gone home based on these parameters? Do you think that's going to be problematic, or this is just an interesting tool for us to have in the toolbox?
I think this is probably an interesting tool and stays kind of just in the orthopedic specific toolbox. I mean, you could like postulate any of these things, like, well, what if insurance got their hands on it and then they could turn it again? I mean, any of these things they could sort of, you know, turn against you. Like, you didn't operate on the pathologic fracture before, you know, and now that it broke, like, you're responsible for everything that happens after the fact. So I don't think that they're going to, you know, adopt the click six score. They might sort of say, like, the one way I could see it going is that they say, like, what's the click six score or the six clicks score? It's kind of like a tongue twister there. And, you know, if it's not high enough and you're trying to send them to a skilled nursing facility or something like that, they say, no, we won't approve it because the score doesn't meet that. That's the only way that I could sort of see that going. Not that it would fall back on orthopedic surgeons.
Interesting. Not more.
Right.
More, hopefully.
Does meniscal extrusion make you think twice in high tibial osteotomies?
So I personally don't do HTOs, but we have many colleagues who do. This is the article by Yang et al. Looking at the extent of preoperative medial meniscal extrusion influencing immediate term outcomes after medial opening wedge high tibial osteotomy. It is free for 30 days, also like the other article, so don't forget that. And there's a visual summary. So double bonuses here. So there's a good ways here. So it's an interesting idea, right? You look at a patient, they come in with an MRI, they get an HTO, younger patients tend to undergo this. And does the meniscal extrusion correlate to how they do? Now, they only looked at a meniscal extrusion here, you know, how many millimeters it goes outwards, and they use multiple different scores, 3 millimeter being their main cutoff of, you know, poor versus, you know, good outcome, more extrusion being bad, less extrusion being good in theory. It would be actually interesting to evaluate things like gap size to add to it. So for example, how much did they have to jack open the HTO? Did that make a difference in regards to outcome? But they're just looking at meniscal extrusion. So it's nice in that this is a very straightforward study. You're looking at one parameter and how it correlates in that way. Personally, I would think that longer follow-up would be good, especially after an HTO. Now, intermediate's great. Most other studies have been, you know, 1 or 2 years. This is intermediate, minimum 5-year follow-up. But obviously, we want to keep following these cohorts out for 10, 15, 20 years, because the idea is it's supposed to prevent them to undergo total knee replacements, which where I come in. Now, I do like to delay it to a point, obviously. And it's one of those things where the longer is better. One thing to look at these is this cohort of patients is, for example, CPMs we're using these patients. We don't use CPMs regularly in our patients now. So the grading systems are good for the extruded meniscus. They use pre-op MRIs, which is obviously important. That's what the patients come in and you can give them, say, hey, look, maybe an HTO is a good thing. This is your survival rate or revision rate. And this is what I'm going to go with. But it would be actually kind of interesting. Some of these patients get post-op MRIs as well, too. You know, does it change the meniscal extrusion there? Does that actually make an impact with regards to how their HTOs work as well, too? The authors did use the word prove, so I don't love using the word prove in research studies. So that's just something I think out there for the general audience. Nothing really is proven. We're showing correlation or things like that, but proving is pretty hard to show in these areas. But it did show that meniscal tear pattern arthritis greater relates to the extent of medial meniscal extrusion, which is not surprising, right? You don't want to say these things and you don't want to say they're proven, but they're obviously known to correlate well together. So those with more meniscal extrusions did worse, which is not surprising again, which as we've shown in other of our studies too. And it's just indicative of more severe arthritis later on in life. What's interesting though, the survival rates and the time to total knee arthroplasty were the same. Does that matter to patients? You know, is that just for patient information? Does it matter to us? If a meniscal extrusion is more than 3 millimeters, less than 3 millimeters, the survival rates and time to TK are the same. And that's normally our take-home metric, right? So do the results here make a huge difference with regards to how we counsel patients, or is it just telling patients, hey, look, this is what to expect after surgery?
I think it does make a difference. I think it makes a difference that if they're in like the high risk group that has this, you know, it doesn't matter what you do, the time to the surgery is the same, or maybe even in the low risk group, it's almost like it left me asking, like, why are you having this other surgery? Now, I know that there are reasons, of course, for doing high tibial osteotomy where, you know, the patient is, you know, far too young for total knee arthroplasty, but, you know, setting everything aside and they're already developing arthritis, et cetera, it's almost like questioning, like, you know, you're making people have another incremental surgery that is fairly morbid, has a definable complication profile, and then that's going to make the total knee replacement all that much harder, right? More scar tissue, more soft tissue devascularization potentially already, more dissection, removing hardware. So I think there's a lot of food for thought here beyond even the talking points that the authors are expostulating.
I hear you. It's one of those interesting things where, you know, this is a counseling area for my patients when it comes to, they say, oh, should I undergo an HTO? Now, if they're older patients, it becomes a little bit different. For the younger patients, it is. So more pain, that's just one of those things where I always say that, like, if you have more pain, that's, you know, you're also going non-weight bearing for a period of time. The recovery is a lot harder. So when it goes to total knee, it's almost a totally different ballgame for recovery and everything. But it is interesting. I like these. A lot of these topics here that we're going through have a lot of clinical applicability. So this would give me pause, not in a bad way, not in a cases and hold way, but say, should I undergo this HTO if I have a lot of meniscal extrusion? So that was my thought.
Check it out, everybody.
All right.
All right. Look at the big finish. We're going to have to go fast.
All right. Question for you. Pathoanatomy. Tell me about the anterior lateral tibial fragment and ankle fractures.
Yes. So this is a very, very granular focused study out of Germany, 140 patients with ankle fractures where they really characterized the pathoanatomy of the anterolateral tibial fragment. They develop an algorithm that has three different types, and the three different types are going to inform how you approach it and management strategies. And those are actually the best kind of classifications. Easy to understand, easy for surgeons to relate to patients, and then also informative of patient care. Definitely check this one out. Mm-hmm. And I have for you emergency department stress radiographs of lateral compression type 1 pelvic ring injuries. These are safe, effective, and reliable from De Kaiser and colleagues.
So not to be confused with Kaiser, so say it's De Kaiser. And it's one of those things where I completely agree. This is also a clinically applicable one. I recommend this. They basically said, can you check these patients in the emergency room and do a UA essentially? And they look at specifically LC1 type injuries involving complete sacral fracture only. So it is a specific patient population. We're honest, and they say, we don't know if the 10 millimeter displacement is a good cutoff or not, but historically that's been used in literature. And they said that if you did in the ER, you did in the OR, they're a correlative. If they didn't move or displace more than 10 millimeters and you let them weight bear, and if they could weight bear, they actually went on to clinical, and they said, and functional union. So that's pretty good. This is a very useful study. I can remember being a resident, and if we didn't take a lot of these back to the OR to do, we didn't even do EUs, A's at the time, actually. That's really developed over time. So this is really useful that you can do this in the emergency room as opposed to the operating room. They did exclude pregnant patients, which is true for most studies, I would say, but actually it would be kind of interesting to see a baseline value of pregnant patients and how much they should displace, thinking that maybe they might displace a lot more. So instead of fixing them, they may not need to be fixed. And that's a whole nother study in and of itself, but that was an excluded patient group. It would be nice to obviously have a larger patient population. They didn't save all the images from the operating room to see how much they displaced, but that would have been really good to have. So they only got 9 out of 13, and even 13 is not a lot of patients. One of the questions that I left with is, do we need an EUA everyone at all? Now, it's good for us to know, you know, how much they displace and radiographic information. And obviously more data is good because more is better, obviously, as we're getting from this is more tests, you know, but if they're a high energy trauma, they're more likely to need to be fixed. Or if they have complete sacral fracture with bilateral rami fractures and segmental and parasympathial superior rami fractures, maybe they should be fixed without having to need to do an MUA because there's such a high likelihood of being unstable. But the take home message is neat. Do an EUA in the emergency room and you'll probably do pretty well to find out the difference.
All right. That's everything from the scientific standpoint today. I think we have a second for mail call, a little bit of an update here. So since the podcast has been getting a lot of really positive feedback, both from the community online and also, you know, getting texts and emails and phone calls from friends, I've had, you know, folks text me and be like, oh, you know, you need to reach like an international audience. Like it should be translated. And interestingly enough, they do translations, like full on translations, or they have in the past of JBJS. So maybe we can get this, translated internationally and reach an even wider audience that isn't English speaking. What do you think?
I'm in. That'd be great. And there's so many different languages to translate into. It'd be really, really fun.
Right. You have to go with like the most popular ones, I guess, like Spanish for sure. So I'll take a stab at that. Okay. Mucho gusto y bienvenidos al podcast de JBJS. Su caso está en pausa. Soy Andrés y ella está mi querida amiga Antonia Chen. Ya te dije, el caso, el equipo de JBJS está en fuego.
Wow.
Or how about Greek?
That was super impressive.
How about Greek? Carlos, ήρθατε στο podcast από το JBJS. Η υπόθεσή σας βρίσκεται σε πάυση. Είμαι Ανδρέας και είναι καλή μου φίλη Αντώνια Τσέν.
I wish I had prepared this. This is very much off the cuff. Chinese is probably the only thing I can offer in English.
Yeah, do it.
大家好，谢谢你来那个 JBJS podcast. 我是陈医生， and 这个是 Schoenfeld 医生。我们两个要一起讲话， so 希望你跟我们一起讲这个 JBJS 每一个两个礼拜回来讲这个东西。 谢谢你。 Mine
awesome.
Is a little kid Chinese though. So to my Chinese colleagues, thank you. We can prepare better and be ready for you guys.
I'm not sure that my Spanish or Greek is any better, just to be honest.
It sounded really professional to me. So in.
I'm
going to subscribe. Well, thanks for listening. And we'll come back to you hopefully in different languages sometime.
Stay tuned.
And stay tuned for the next Your Case is on Hold.